As I mentioned this morning, I want to start another series with you tonight. Sometimes we do topical studies as we go throughout the scriptures. Sometimes we do other studies where we go through a book and do expository preaching like we do with 1 Corinthians and spend a good time, a good deal of time on that subject. But what I want to do in this series is something a little bit different, to give a broad overview of the various books of the Bible. We spend a lot of time in learning doctrinal details of the New Testament books, but sometimes we don't think about how the books fit together as an overall message of God. So I'd like to spend a few Sunday nights helping us get an overview of the various books of the Bible. And tonight's lesson, we're going to kick off with an overview of the Gospels. Maybe you've wondered sometimes why we have four Gospels instead of one, and how do the four Gospels fit together, and are they unique? I think a good overview of the Gospels help us understand how they fit together and what the purpose of each one of those Gospels is. And sometimes when we look at the Gospels, we have to deduce the audience that it was intended for by some of the things that we see in the Gospels. It's not always explicitly stated, now this book was written for this purpose to these people. Luke may be an exception to that, but as we look at these, we see some pretty telling signs of who it was that was the intended audience of each book, and who would get the most out of reading those. And I think it's an interesting thing to look at. The first thing that we'll see is that each gospel was written to a different audience, just much like our presentation of the gospel of Christ depends on who it is that we're talking to, doesn't it? If we in my line of work, I do a lot of training, and one of the first things I try to do is find out what the person knows before I start training them. If they already know a lot of the things that I was going to cover, then I skip over those things. But if they're a beginner, if they came from a different background than I did, or maybe their job was different at a previous time, I try to tailor my message to who it is that I'm talking to so that they'll get the best benefit. And we see the same type of thing in the Gospels. The Gospels are written to different audiences. And so it just depends on the nature of the audience, whether they're knowledgeable of the Scriptures and whether they're believers or unbelievers. Those are things that we would certainly keep in mind. And the Gospel writers had different audiences in mind when they wrote the various Gospels. Another reason for the different Gospels is because there may be a different purpose. And sometimes that purpose is very well stated in the Gospels. And we'll see that the purpose of each one of the Gospels is not the same. And there's a specific intent that's expressly stated or implied by the writer. So we want to look at that in that context tonight. And we'll do the same thing as we go through the other books of the New Testament. But we'll start off with Matthew, of course. And it doesn't take much deducing to see that the Gospel of Matthew was written to a predominantly Jewish audience. There are many Jewish aspects found in the Gospel that are not found in the other three Gospels. In fact, if you look at Matthew chapter 1, what do we see? Well, we see that Jesus' genealogy is traced to Abraham and David, the fathers of Israel and keepers of the promise of the Messiah. So that would be something that the Jews would be very interested in, and that's what we see the book starting out telling us. And with the first verse, the book of genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham, and it goes through the genealogies. And sometimes, I'll just tell you my feeling on genealogies. It's not my favorite thing to study. But I understand, why it was important to the Jewish audience. And I think we have more of appreciation for it when we understand the audience. Now, us not being Jews and not tied to personally to genealogies, we may not think about that as much. But here, the promises of the Messiah and being the son of David and the son of Abraham would particularly matter to the the Jewish audience. And in fact, when you look throughout the gospel, and we won't take time to read all these scriptures, we'll just make some references to some of them. But if you look throughout the gospel of Matthew, it really does focus on how the Messiah came through these people. In fact, in chapter 1, and chapter 9, and chapter 12, chapter 15, chapter 20, chapter 21, and chapter 22, you see Matthew referring to Jesus as the Son of David. And that's a way that Matthew constantly refers to David in the book of Matthew. And the other Gospels don't do that. They don't refer to Jesus as the Son of David. And another evidence of this being a Jewish audience that Matthew is addressing, it records many of the Jewish customs. Now, some of the other Gospels do that too. But sometimes in the other Gospels, there's an explanation of the Jewish custom. But Matthew does not take the time to explain, you know, what the customs are, because the Jews already understand the context of those customs. They already understand what those customs are. And so, and that's one of the unique things about the book of Matthew. In fact, Matthew contains some unique material, such as the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is only found in Matthew's gospel and not the others. And if you think about what Jesus teaches in the Sermon on the Mount, most of it is a correction of Jewish misunderstandings of the law. Jesus is saying, you have heard this, but I say this. And so that's a unique element that we see in Matthew explaining, or Jesus explaining some things that were not maybe relevant to others, but certainly relevant to the Jews and their misunderstandings of the law of Moses. Another important unique element is in the Gospel of Matthew is that Matthew speaks about the kingdom of heaven. In fact, the phrase kingdom of heaven is not found anywhere else in the scriptures, but it's found in Matthew 32 times, the phrase kingdom of heaven. And the phrase kingdom of God only appears 4 times. And so that's another interesting thing, because, you know, the Jews are looking for that kingdom, and it's mentioned over and over and over. So we see that the audience, and we can deduce that the audience is particularly Jewish or predominantly Jewish because of the things that are addressed and how they are addressed and the things that are left out too. The purpose is so that Matthew can prove that Jesus is the Messiah, and one of the things that's pointed out is because Jesus fulfilled the prophecies of the Messiah. The Old Testament is full of prophecies regarding the Messiah, the King of Israel, and that's who Jesus is, and Matthew has the most quotations from the Old Testament than any of the other gospel writers, pointing back to what was foretold about the coming Messiah. So the purpose, obviously, of these numerous quotations is to prove that Jesus was the Messiah because he fulfilled these prophecies. In Matthew chapter 1, verse 17, Matthew says, "Then what was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled." And so the book starts out, you know, showing that Jesus' life is fulfilling these prophecies that we see in the Old Testament. And after using those words, then there's a quotation of the Old Testament. And, of course, only the Jewish people would primarily be concerned that Jesus fulfilled those prophecies of the Messiah. And Matthew repeats over and over evidence to prove that Jesus is the King of Israel. Matthew also not only uses prophecies to prove that Jesus is the Messiah, but he also gives the fullest account of Jesus' discords. If you look in chapter 7, verse 28, chapter 11, chapter 13, chapter 19, and chapter 26, and when Jesus gives a discourse, when he gives some teaching, it always says when Jesus has finished these sayings, when Jesus had finished these sayings. And so every time there is an opportunity for Jesus to speak, it's always wrapped up so that there's a very clear understanding of who it is that's speaking and that it's Jesus. And so when you read those discourses of Jesus, you keep those purposes and that audience in mind. The audience is the Jewish people. And so when you read Matthew, if you're thinking like first century Jews, then you have a better, proper understanding of what it is that you're reading and how those teachings are written down by Matthew. We also consider how, these discourses that are recorded go about proving that Jesus was the King of Israel, the prophesied Messiah. So really, that's an overview of Matthew and who it was that was written to and the purpose. Now, the Gospel of Mark, Matthew had the Jewish audience as his target, and it appears that Mark had a Roman audience in mind when he wrote his Gospel. And there's a number of reasons why it appears that this Gospel was written for the Roman mind. It is the shortest of all the Gospels, and it is known about the Romans that they like to receive their information quickly and succinctly, and it's also translated. There's Aramaic words that Mark translated for his readers, showing that the Jewish people were not his audience. And another thing that we see that Mark does is when there are things that would not be understood by the Roman audience as far as Jewish customs, those things are explained. Remember, I said that in Matthew, Jewish customs were never explained, but Mark does explain those things. There's an example in Mark chapter 7 and verses 3 and 4. Mark chapter 7, verses 3 and 4. I'll back up just a little bit and go to verse 1. When the Pharisees gathered to him some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, they saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. The Jews would not have to be, that would not have to be explained to the Jews what it meant to eat with defiled hands or unwashed hands. But, we get an aside here in Mark. It says, "For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders, and when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches." So you see there how it's explained that the reason that the disciples are being accused about this is because of their custom, because of their human custom. So Mark doesn't, he gives us that information that the Romans would not know. And so I think that's very interesting that Mark tells us those things. Also, Mark uses Latin expressions rather than Greek. Latin was the Roman language. And Mark records time also based upon the Roman system of timekeeping. Mark also does not include information that would not concern the Roman people. There's no genealogy of Jesus. The gospel starts out the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. It does not backtrack like Matthew did into the genealogies. And so rather than using a genealogy, Mark uses the language of the Roman Empire. The gospel to the Romans was a good thing to consider, to have this type of ruler or king, and the title Son of God was sometimes used of an emperor. And Mark is not interested in speaking about who begot who and who begot who, but wants to communicate the important point that would grab the Romans' interest. Listen to the glad tidings about the king. Now that they understood. They understood what a strong ruler was. And so Jesus being, powerful, Jesus being the emperor of the world, that would be something that they would understand. Someone that was powerful that should grab their attention. Also, another thing that you see in Mark is that he speaks about events happening rapidly. You can see that in the first chapter of Mark. In chapter 1, verse 10, it says, "Immediately coming from the water." In chapter 1, verse 12, "Immediately the Spirit Verse 18, immediately they left their nets. Verse 20, immediately he called them. They went up to Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered. And verse 28 of chapter 1, immediately his fame spread. And you see that many times here just in the first chapter of Mark, immediately. So it's boom, boom, boom. It's very quick. It's very rapid. And so all of these words that speed up the story seems to be a purpose that Mark has. He wants to tell this very succinctly, and it really does go hand in hand with what we understand about the Romans. So the purpose that Mark has is there's no need to teach the Romans that Jesus is the King of Israel and that he's the prophesied Messiah. That's not of the same interest to them that it is to the Jews. They're not going to care as much about that information. And many writers suggest that the purpose of this gospel is to show Jesus as the suffering servant. And you've probably heard that before. And rather than that being the purpose, it does not seem that the Romans would be that interested in seeing Jesus as the suffering servant, but to show him as being powerful. That seems to fit more with what the Romans would think was exemplary about Jesus. And so the claim that you see first in the gospel is that Jesus is the Son of God. And how are you going to prove that? How are you going to show that? Well, the book of Mark goes on to show Jesus' accomplishments. And so that would be something that is significant to them, to show his accomplishments. The Roman emperors proved their worth to people by recording and declaring what it was that they had done and their monuments and their many achievements and their conquests throughout the world. And Mark goes on about proving that who Jesus is, that he is the Son of God through his achievements. You see that in Mark. And when you look at Mark, the gospel devotes more time to miracles than any other gospel. And so the achievements of Jesus is being shown to the Roman people. Over half of the miracles performed by Jesus are found in the Gospel of Mark, of the ones that we have recorded. So when you study Mark, you're looking for the action of Jesus' life that proves to the Roman mind that Jesus is the Son of God. And his miracles, you know, prove that he's the ruler of the world. If you believe that he did those miracles, you know, there's no way that he could do that except he be God. And Luke, his audience has often been said that it was to the Greeks, and that assumption is derived from details that you see that Luke gives that are not given in the other gospel accounts. Luke uses Greek terminology instead of Hebrew words. You know, one example is found in Luke 23, where he calls the place of the crucifixion Calvary, and he's the only one that does that. The other gospels call the location Golgotha. So he's using a Greek word, Greek terminology to describe this place. And you know, there are other gospel accounts that use words like Abba and Rabbi and Hosanna that you don't see used in Luke. Luke does not use those words. He uses Greek equivalents for a lot of the words that you see in the other gospels. And Luke does not often quote the Old Testament, and that's in real sharp contrast to what you see in the book of Matthew. Now, when he does quote from the Old Testament, he uses the Septuagint, which you may have heard of before. It was the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures. And so when he does quote from the Old Testament, he uses the Greek translation that they would be familiar with. So, you know, many details are given in Luke's account that are not found in other Gospels, and things that would be important to the Greek mind. So that's some of the reasoning that people have used to determine that it seems that Luke's gospel had the Greek mind in view. A couple of stated reasons for purposes of Luke, and you know, one certainly is explicitly stated, as we see at the beginning of Luke, and probably a lot of you already know what that is that he wanted to show a narrative about Jesus. He wanted to show Jesus' life in chronological order. In Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. Inasmuch as I have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely from time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things which you have been taught. And so this orderly account, this would have been a chronological account. So Luke declares that Theophilus, his intent is to write an orderly sequence, a narrative in an orderly way. And so Luke, his purpose is different. He's not trying to show that Jesus is the Messiah, or Jesus is the King of Israel, or Jesus is the Son of God. He's wanting to give a picture chronologically of the life of Christ. And so you can see that because he explicitly says that. And Luke goes to great lengths in his gospel to reveal the humanity of Jesus. There's a lot of detail in the book of Luke that's not found elsewhere. The first couple of chapters in Luke's gospel are about the birth of John the Baptist, and then the birth of Jesus, and then the childhood of Jesus. Also, there is a genealogy in Luke that's traced back to Adam. And Luke spends a lot of his time recording the parables of Jesus. If you're ever sitting there thinking, well, I've got to give an invitation tonight and I forgot that I was supposed to do it, or you're filling in for somebody else and you want to do something, well, I think I'll do something on one of the parables, and you can't remember where it is, chances are it's in Luke. If you go there, that's where most of the parables are recorded. Luke also repeatedly speaks about the Gentiles and the Samaritans and other outcasts who found grace in the eyes of Jesus, but certainly were not looked upon favorably by the Jews. And so when you look at Luke's gospel, one of the purposes is to see this chronological narrative of Jesus' life, and you also get a good idea about the humanity of Jesus. And so that purpose that we see in Luke. Finally, in John, what we see in John is that the audience of John seems to be universal, because the book of John, or the Gospel of John, is considered to be have written about 90 AD. And so this would have been decades after the other Gospels had been penned. And because of the content of John's gospel, it seems to be universal in the context of what audience was intended in this writing. And John is probably, you know, the most unique of all the gospels. And John did not specify any group of people, you know, like the other gospels did. Much more detail is given in the book of John about the last days of Jesus that you don't find in the other Gospels. There is a lot of detail about the final week of Christ that's found in John. In fact, nearly half of the Gospel is spent talking about the last days of Jesus. And so that's certainly of a universal appeal, and it allows John to write, you know, what we would consider a much more theological book, a doctrinal book, rather than a narrative like we see in the book of Luke. So the theological emphasis can really be seen right as the book begins. And this is an often quoted verse in John chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Well, there's a lot that's said there, right? Rather than given a genealogy or beginning with a narrative, John opens up and says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And so, theologically speaking, that's kind of heavy, isn't it? It's a sentence that describes the nature of and the beginning of Jesus. So it's really different than the way the other Gospels begin. And because John is a theological book, people consider it to be more difficult, you know, to read than some of the other Gospels, or, you know, certainly would be when you compare it. I don't think it's hard to understand, but it's more complex because you're talking about theological statements rather than narratives. But the purpose that John had in writing the book is stated in John chapter 20, verse 30 and 31. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples that were not written in this book. But these are written so that you can believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and by believing you may have life on his name. So John says the purpose of the gospel is to prove that Jesus is God. So then you would not expect to read John's gospel to find out about the narrative life of Jesus. Now, John's purpose is not telling all the things that Jesus did, and he admits that point. His point is that I'm telling you what I'm telling you so that I can prove a point that Jesus is the Son of God. John, in comparison to the other Gospels, he only records 7 miracles, and Mark records nearly 3 times as many miracles. And so the reason that you see the Gospels are different, they're different because they have a different purpose. And you want one of the things that you see that those who want to discredit the Bible, they'll look at the 4 Gospels and say, look how different they are. You know, look, you know, some things one writer says are not recorded by another, or it's said in a different way. Well, it's meant to be that way. And so the reason that they are different is because each author had a different purpose. And when you're studying John, you are going to learn things that you may not learn in one of the other Gospels. So, you know, we have 4 Gospels, not 1. And again, I just want to reiterate that we can too easily misuse the Gospels when we fail to remember that each one had a different audience and a different purpose. And when you think about the different audience and the different purpose, it really helps our understanding. One thing that can help us when we're trying to teach someone else is, you know, I think one of the most natural things that people may do when they open up the New Testament, and just as a side note, I think it's a shame to have these Bibles that are the New Testament only. You know, I understand that they're less expensive, it's less pages, but you know, a lot of times when you see a copy of the Bible, it has the New Testament, it has Psalms and Proverbs maybe in the back of it. You know, you're not getting a full picture of the Bible when you just read that. But aside from that, if you start reading the New Testament and you start reading Matthew, and the first thing, you being a Gentile and not a Jew, you start reading about these genealogies. Well, that does not interest me, or that does not apply to me, unless you understand why it was written. There's more context that helps us to have an appreciation for those things. But what I'm saying is, somebody that's new to the Bible, you may want to encourage them to read Mark first, because that gives them a more concise view of who Jesus is, and it leaves out some of the detail that they may not need right away. And so it wouldn't make sense to initiate somebody to the life of Jesus by reading the Gospel of Matthew, unless that person, you know, were Jewish. And, you know, the average American, I'd say, is probably not going to care as much about the fulfillment of prophecy that points to Jesus being the king of Israel. And Mark and Luke are the Gospels that may be better for unbelievers to read. And sometimes people suggest that maybe an unbeliever should read Mark first because the Roman mind has some similarities to our mindset today, because we want things short, we want things quick. And Mark is the most concise way to learn about Jesus Christ. Certainly these are things that can be talked about. I'm just trying to help us to understand that different audiences sometimes need different things, and that is why we have 4 different Gospels. I can remember years ago that a Bible class that I was in studied a book called The Harmony of the Gospels, and so what it tried to do is to harmonize all of them, and then, you know, as I've thought more about it, maybe trying to harmonize them all together is not what was intended at all. And that's, you know, the reason I think that sometimes people try to harmonize the Gospels and make them all fit together is because they're trying to answer a skeptic who is saying that, well, things are different in this book from another book. And a man named Cedlo Baxter wrote a book called Explore the Book, and he said it this way. He said, it may sound strange, but the harmony of the four Gospels is best appreciated not by destroying, but preserving their diversities. So understanding the diversities of the four Gospels, who they were written to and what their purposes are, really serves us better than trying to dump all of them into a blender and combine them all together. I think you can see just in this short lesson tonight that they had different authors, they had different purposes, and they had different audiences, and that was on purpose, and that's the way that God wanted it. And it helps everybody to read with a purpose, to understand who Jesus was. So when we read a gospel, it's helpful for us to read the gospel with the mindset of the intended audience, and then we get the right idea. So I hope this is interesting to you, and as we go throughout the rest of these lessons, we will be doing similar things as we look at each one of the books of the Bible, try to give an overview of who was writing, when it was written, and why it was written, so that we can have a better understanding of the purpose of all of the Scriptures. Tonight, we haven't been talking about what it is that you need to do to become a Christian, but certainly if you started reading the Gospels and learned about Jesus Christ, you would have an appreciation for the man who is the Son of God and would want to be loyal to the one who gave his life for you and gave you an opportunity for a home in heaven. When you get to the book of Acts, you understand how to do that, as we've been studying in our classes. You are buried in baptism and arise to walk a new life. If we can help you in any way to be obedient to the gospel, we'd invite you to come while we stand and sing.